to a gunfight. See you, children. The Lord bless you as you go.
Yeah, that's a weird phrase to follow that up with. But
you don't take a knife to a gunfight. The classic illustration of this, I know weeks ago I mentioned Raiders of the Lost Ark, and that's an old movie, so some of you young folks might not have seen it, but there's the classic scene, right? For those who haven't seen the movie Raiders of the Lost Ark, you have Indiana Jones and his ex-girlfriend Marion on this frenetic search for the lost Ark of the Covenant, because there are Nazis looking for it as well. And there's, in that movie, it has these magic powers, and if the Nazis get it, they'll rule the world and have dominion. And so it is just chase scene after chase scene and panicked, scenes of danger and peril that they're narrowly escaping. But there's this one scene in the multiple scenes where that happens, where they're in a Middle Eastern market, because that's, they've gone to the Middle East to try and find the Ark, and they're in this market, and they're being chased at this point by a few Nazis, but mostly by these black turban wearing men who are chasing after them with knives, and some of them are large, and Marion, for example, wallops one of them. You know, it's just moment after moment of escape. She wallops one of them with a frying pan that's in the market, because they're in this market and it's packed with people, but they're running through. It's just chaos. But then it comes to the well-known scene, and Indian running comes into the main square of the market, and the crowd spreads out to reveal that about 20 feet away is this huge man in a black robe with a large scimitar. And that man starts waving the scimitar and starts laughing this evil laugh, and you think, oh no, and Indiana Jones rolls his eyes, takes out his gun, and just goes, and the guy falls. You don't bring a knife to a gunfight. It's a phrase we use to describe this idea that, like, the resources that you thought you were showing up with have actually proven to be very inadequate. Right? As one website put it, this is a phrase we use that when someone has come into a situation that with what they think is sufficient, only to realize that they're severely outmatched. To be outmatched, overpowered, in trouble with the things you trusted in and thought were adequate and worthwhile, only to find that they're worthless. Well, if we are honest as humans, God often feels like a knife in the middle of a gunfight. Does that sound harsh? Haven't you been there? I have this week to feel like there are just some things that are really large and really big, and God, really? That there's a knife fight going on. I'm sorry, a gunfight going on, and the only thing I can do is say, God, that doesn't even work in a knife fight. And then in our age, just to be human is to struggle with that in the secular age. Because we have folks that will say, no, I understand the world without God, and I understand how this stuff works apart from God. And so the very mention of God, science explains things, psychology explains things. And so whether you believe or don't believe, whether you are a Christian or not yet a Christian, in our culture, in our world today, God feels weak, easily dismissed, inadequate. Or at least if we believe, we can feel a little uncertain, unstable, and feel that he's irrelevant at times, can't we? And it's, what do we do with that? That's the question we ask. How do we move forward with that? There's long answers and lots of work that we need to do, but what does this passage say? We bring our questions like this every week to passages, to our passage. And so we come to this one, and as you know, I'm continuing our series from Lent into Easter of entering in. We've been looking at Numbers, and we're now at chapter 13. We're going to pick up some other chapters and move along a little bit here, but we'll finish just some of the highlights now between here and Easter. But we come to this passage, and what does it say to us in this Easter season of hope, where we know still, yes, resurrection's happened. But there's still weeks where we go, God, you seem like a knife in a gunfight. Well, there's three things I want to organize our thoughts around. Just these. This. What? Why is this passage relevant? Why this passage is relevant? What this passage reveals and what this passage recommends. So why it's relevant, reveals, recommends. Why this passage is relevant, what this passage reveals, and what this passage recommends. So first, why this passage is relevant. Let's remember the story. We're only in Numbers, right? So Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers. We're in the fourth book of the Bible. So God created in Genesis, everything was good, but we rebelled. Mankind went their own way and disbelieved God and did not follow him. And so as a result, there's a curse on everything. Our relationship with God, our relationship with ourselves, our relationship with one another, and our relationship with the world. All of it's broken. But God promises to rescue, and he does that. And he starts moving his plan forward. And in moving his plan forward, he chooses a man, Abraham, but his descendants go to Egypt and they get enslaved. Well, he promises, now we're into Exodus, he raises up a leader, Moses, to rescue them. And there's this great deliverance, not by Moses, but by God. And they go into the desert, and there God gives them the law. So we're into Leviticus. They're at Sinai. They make it there in Exodus. But they're at this mountain called Sinai and get the very law of God, not just because God's a lawgiver, but because it's a law of love. And God says, I want relationship with you. I want to know you and be in covenant relationship with you. And they're at Sinai, and then we started Numbers. And do you remember how this starts? With numbers. They number the army, but that's because God has said, I've promised a land for you to go take. And so they constitute an army. And that's how Numbers started. And then they got ready to leave. And in chapter 10, 4 weeks ago now for us, they left Sinai. But then if you remember in 11, the last sermon we had in this series, they rebelled, grumbled, and complained about meat. Well, 11... they complain about meat. In 12, they complain about leadership, Miriam and Aaron. And now we come to 13 and 14, which are one story about this spy story, which is really well known. So that's where we are. But why is this, what's my point? Why is it relevant? Well, it's relevant because of how I started this sermon. They face strong adversaries, don't they? I mean, that's what they've gone in and they say what? They say, we've seen fortified cities. We've seen people who are massive. These Anak, however you want to say it, that literally means neck. These people that are like neck, head and shoulders above us and huge. They're descendants of like, we think that the theory was they had the kind of the myth of these godlike creatures. They will, what do they say? They will devour our women and children. In verse 3, our wives and little ones will be prey. They have these massive obstacles. You know, I didn't print a lot of chapter 13. You can see that. I have 1 and 2 in there, and then we jump to 25. So it's a long, I did that to spare us all the long, long reading of this story. But in there, they're sent out. First, you find out who they are. They're sent out. Moses just sends them on a reconnaissance mission, saying, go get information for us because it would be valuable. But they come back with a bad report. This, if you look at your passage in verse 28, circle the however, your first word there, because as one commentator put it, in the Hebrew, it is a strong adversative. That is, it is a huge but. Junior high boys just mind and all men just went there. But it's a huge, sorry, it's a huge adversity. It's this turn. It's like, I know he said this, but. The people who dwell there are strong, so they face obstacles. And it's relevant. Why? Because you face obstacles. But here's the bigger thing. You knew all of this. You could read this on your own, and I had missed this until the commentators pointed out. There's a huge thing in this passage that we kind of will miss here because I didn't put in verses 3 through 23. Look for the word Lord, the name of God. Verse 1, circle it. Now, when's the next time it shows up? Not down till the bottom of the page of chapter 14, verse 3, when the people are complaining. And commentators point out that's on purpose. Because the author wants you to hear the silence of God. And there is no mention of his name. There is no mention of his promises. There is simply silence in human endeavors, human strategizing, humans trying to solve the problem or make their own plans, and they don't even talk about God in the midst of it. But we are to hear that silence. What's my point? Why is this relevant? Because God's apparent silence in the midst of our obstacles is exactly what every human struggles with. God's apparent distance in the midst of struggles, his apparent where are you, where are the why questions that we ask, these powerful obstacles that create fear, right? That's what we're told they wrestle with. You know, I've often told the story of Kent Merker. Kent Merker was, for those of you that are Atlanta Braves fans, Lou, I believe that's you. Kent Merker threw for the Braves in the 80s, the late 80s and the 90s. He started in 89 and threw through 95. If you know the Braves, they won the pennant, or they went to the World Series three times, won the pennant once, and once in that season when he threw for them were in the National League final but lost. They were a powerhouse at the time. My point is, Kent Merker threw for a rival high school of ours. And there's many details. I've used this illustration before with him. But in this one, we would show up to the game, and there are three guys with pro scout hats on and speed guns writing down everything he did, right? I mean, it was intimidating. But that entire week, because we knew that was going to happen, we'd seen the articles about him and that he's getting recruited and all, he went straight to the majors. Well, he went to Michigan for like a year or two. Boo, Michigan. I'm from Ohio, for those of you that are guests. That was uncalled for. Okay. But that entire week, our coach was a broken record. You can hit this guy. You can hit this guy. You can hit this guy. And guess what I did? I got a double off of him. He probably threw me a changeup. But my point is, what would have been like to sit in silence with that instead, right? Don't you want to hear, you can do it. You've got this. That's the words we offer each other. But instead, silence. God not being mentioned in the face of obstacles. We live there. That's why this passage is relevant. That took a lot of time. Never mind. Don't allude to time, Pastor. Okay, second one. That's why this passage is relevant. We obviously, before we move on, want to ask, what are your obstacles? God seems really comfortable with this science, with this silence. And though our obstacles may not be spying out land, we all struggle with fear. What are the obstacles in your life that are creating fear? And what do you do with that fear? Which leads us to our drives this sermon on, really. So why this passage is relevant, secondly, what this passage reveals. This passage obviously reveals a disbelief in God and a disobedience, right? Look at verse 3. Why is the Lord bringing us into this land to fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become prey. Would it not be better for us to go back to Egypt? This is rebellion against the Lord. As a matter of fact, our last verse that you have printed in verse 11, God says they are despising him, but they're charging, as Timothy Ashley wrote, they charge Yahweh with abandoning them to a sure death in Canaan. Do you see that there's a contrast here that's easily missed? Look how this passage started. Verse 1, the Lord spoke to Moses saying, send men to spy out the land of Canaan. How's he describe it? Which I am giving to the people of Israel. There's a promise. Notice when the men come back, what do they say in 27? Verse 27, just a few lines down. And they told him, that is Moses, we came to the land to which you sent us. Why did I put the emphasis on you sent us? Because if you read Numbers, all the other times that it's talking about the land, guess what phrase it uses? The land which the Lord our God is giving us. They are not believing God. They are despising him, rejecting, and therefore they are not obeying him to go into the land either. Here's my point. What's this revealing? We tend to think, well, they just need to believe. They just need to obey. And we put this kind of just easy bumper sticker on it. Well, you need to just obey. You should believe God. Just recall his faithfulness. Just know what he's doing. And have you ever tried that? It's hard to do. But instead, this reveals a deeper bottom line problem. I kept thinking this week, what would this scene look like if the Israelites had, I don't know, 10 descendants from Anak? 1,000 descendants from Anak. What if they had that? Would they then be like, we don't care, let's go in and fight? But what's my point? They're still not mentioning the name of God, are they? You see, we tend to say they need to believe something else. Or, you know, you need to just believe God. You just need to do. They already are believing something. Do you see that? They're believing in something is going to work in the midst of these obstacles. Something is out there that is going to make life work. Something is going to make them successful, powerful, put together, able to do their dreams and hopes. Something. If they just had this or that. That's what this is revealing about the human heart. Right? We can't just say, well, if you just believed, because they're already believing. They're believing in a false god, is the way the Bible would call it. That's idolatry. And they've got to do the work at what are those things. It is why in verse 9 of chapter 14, when Caleb and Joshua are talking, they say, only do not rebel against the Lord and do not fear the people. They're putting their finger on the fact that being fearful inappropriately, there are appropriate fears. If a lion is chasing you, run. But inappropriate fears are coming from a lack of respect, a lack of worship, a lack of having the Lord as our central place for life, and something else is there. They are undervaluing God because something else is being valued. There is something in their life, and this is where it's relevant to us, right? Or in our lives where we say, I know there's a God, but he is no match for this. My loneliness, my desire for power, control, obedient children, a successful church plant. I mean, do you want me to just, how many hours do you have here for me to show the other things I try to prop myself up with to have a successful, so we made it, right? But we look for places in our fears to perform. Now, so many places we could list. And I do think Israel was saying there are better, stronger things than God, and so do we. I have not read this book fully, but I've heard this illustrations in there. That is Richard Lovelace's book, Dynamics of the Spiritual Life. I think that's what it's called, yeah. But he let's imagine, I'll use his word picture with this illustration. Imagine your ship has gone down and you are way far out at sea and it is you alone. But for some odd reason, this little life buoy comes down. What do? Comes by, you grab it, right? And that way you can at least, it's not a huge one, but you can float on your back and rest a little bit and hang on to that. But soon you see just a few hundred yards away, a ship coming. But it's going fast enough and has enough music playing that they aren't going to see you or hear you. And so you have to wave your arms frantically. And so you have a choice. Do I let go of my life buoy and wave like is necessary to get the boat that will take me to shore? Or will I cling to the life buoy? Idols come into our lives. These other things, these things that we say, just, if I just had, they are our life buoys. They're the little rings, life rings, the buoy ring, whatever they're called. I'm not finding the word. That we cling on to and we refuse to let go and wave our arms at God and say, if you don't bless me, I will die. If you don't show up, I'm in trouble. If you don't hear my lament or whatever it is, my joy. Because they're here and they feel better. And God calls his people to let go of them and to wave frantically at him. See, what are the things in our life that we say, if I just had? Here's some things I wrote down. If I just had power and influence over others, that'd be my control idol. If I just was loved and respected, it'd be my idols for my fear of rejection and those things. If I just had a certain quality of life, if I just had a certain look or body image, if I just could help people so that they could see me as really needed and dependent on me, or kind of, that I'm a helper and a good person. If I just had well-behaved kids, if I just had a better paying job, I don't actually think that last one, because you guys pay me very healthily, thank you. But we all think those. Where are the justs? And our fears expose those, right? What are your fears? My fear of rejection that's going to lead me to cater to other people's needs and not speak truth to them. My fear of failure that's going to lead to overwork. My fear of that my kids will be warped. That, isn't it interesting? This is a great example of how idols can lead to different practices. We all fear that our kids are going to be warped. And we do that in two different ways. One is giving them way too much freedom. The other is being way too strong on them, right? Those are places we can go. Because if I just give them enough freedom, they'll be okay. If I just control them enough, they'll come out okay, right? But we got to get to those. You get the point. Everyone's believing, resting in something, which is important as we move on to our final point, because when folks go, it's again I thought of the story and considering it that when I was doing university work and there was a student who just would come into our meetings and singing songs with his hands raised, but he still kept telling me he didn't believe. And I kept wrestling. And finally, as we talked about his views on God and my views, which he didn't really believe in God or that Jesus was God. And yet I'm hearing how life works. And I said to him, boy, I just wish I had faith like you. And he's like, what? No, you believe. I don't. And I was like, no. And we worked through, you are believing in this and that and this thing to make life work. And you have no proof. You are resting in, everyone rests in something. But we, especially who claim to follow Christ, if you are in this room and claim that, have to do the work to figure out, what are these other things whispering at me? So, what are the things that, when I say, this is what I wrote down, I know life seems scary now, but if I just had blank, I'd be okay. A certainty, I'd be untroubled, I'd have calm. What if I just had blank? So that's why this passage is relevant. That's what it's revealing, is this deeper level of something else that I'm relying on. And finally, what does it recommend? And unfortunately pretty common for me to come to the last point and not want to go too long, because I am too time conscious here for us. What does it reveal? The gospel. And the need for a God who is faithful to his promises and has displayed it in his actions, obviously coming, living, and dying. But how do we see it in this passage? Well, just, there's multiple ways, but consider a few. Look at verse 6. We have so far had, if you read the other section, that is the verses I left out, you know Joshua is one of the spies that goes in. But he's been silent. Notice it's only Caleb that responds at first. Caleb says in verse 30 on your first page. But if you turn it over, Joshua hops in verse 6 of chapter 14, and he agrees with Caleb. When we find that out, commentators say that makes sense, because he's so associated with Moses, he would have probably swayed the field. And so he was probably staying silent at first. There's kind of some things going along that way. But here we have Joshua. My point is simply this. His name is to leap out for us, because what does Joshua mean? Yeshua, that is Yahweh. Shua, salvation. Yahweh is salvation. Yahweh rescues. His name is to make you think of the fact that there is a need for rescue, a deliverance that only God can do, like he did in the Exodus and that he will do. It is to point to our other Yeshua, right? To Jesus, when God himself comes to save and rescue and live the life we couldn't live and die the death we couldn't die, or that we should have died. But that's one. Secondly, verse 8 of chapter 14 there at the end. If the Lord, in this plea that Joshua and Caleb give, if the Lord, what? Delights in us. How do you get the Lord to delight in you? By being united to Christ. Because what has he said about Jesus? When Jesus came up out of the water, he said, "This is my son in whom I am well pleased." This word could be translated, "If God is pleased with us." Actually, I think some translations do it that way. So my point is, this Yeshua who has come and died for us, if we place our faith in him and cling to him for life, we are united to him, and he is already delighted in the Lord. And so what can the Lord say in verses like Zephaniah? "I rejoice over you with singing." How can that be? Because you are seen as wonderful and lovely and my covenant child, because I see you as if you have never blown it. And I see you as if you have no sin, because you are in Jesus. And so we see gospel hints here on that. And then finally, what does verse 10 say? The whole congregation set out to stone them, which is a religious thing. You stone people when they religiously disobey. So they're saying, never mind, we'll go there because we don't have time. But the glory of the Lord appeared in the tent, and then God speaks. What's my point? That what this is recommending is our need to see the gospel in the glory of God, in the mystery of obstacles, in his silence, but in his work in the gospel. That it's the glory of God that changes the scene finally. And you have to read on in chapter, I left out a lot on the back end of 14. It is seeing and beholding the wonder, the weight, the magnitude, the faithfulness, the promises that come out of the goodness of our Father, and sitting there and going, "Whoa, he is glorious." And what did John say when he wrote his gospel? "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God." But then in 1:14, he said, "And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen his glory." You see, Christian, if you are a Christian here, what is our calling? What is this revealing to us? It is revealing our need to again and again have our mind blown by the glorious wonder of what God has done. In an Easter season, where else and what else do we do? There is a practical here too. And it's simply this. It's not just that you get alone with your Bible and try and go, "Jesus is glorious, Jesus is glorious." How does it start happening here? In community. And there's so much more that I could say, but this is why you have two reports. Because there's the faithful community and the unfaithful community. And part of what this is saying, church, as we think of moving forward, entering in, is this series. Will we be a faithful community, being vigilant to help one another expose and understand the other places we're going, but in that, saturating one another with the glorious gospel, not with going, "Well, you should just believe, you should just try harder. Well, I had an experience that did this," but saying there's something going on. And is Jesus magnificent? How can we sit? I need to hear that from you. And you need to hear it from one another, as we see in this passage. Well, other thoughts, but we'll end there. Why is this passage relevant? It is. What's it reveal? The other places, the just we go to. And it recommends that we remember the good news of the cross and the glorious wonder that it gives us a new fear, right? Because I have God. I end with this. You don't bring a knife to a gunfight. I thought of John 21. You know, where Peter's going, well, Lord, what about him after the resurrection in this Easter season? What about him? So he's kind of wrestling with comparison, right? We talk about what are the justs. There's like, well, I want to know his story just like mine. And how am I going to work out? You know, there's probably some performance. There's things like that. And what's Jesus say? You have me. Follow me. That's enough. Church, you have the glorious gospel saying you are well pleased and you have God. May we grow and struggle and labor because that is enough. Let's pray. Lord, that is our ask. We, your church, want to grow at knowing you are the fear that quiets all other fears, because you are the love that saturates all insecurities. So work your gospel into our hearts. In your name we pray these things, and all God's people sang, amen, 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 amen. Let's stand.